Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. As we begin, may I request that you turn off cell phones or anything that might make a noise during the event. Thank you very much. I also want to let you know, you may already be aware of this, but Andrew Cote, who was advertised in our newsletter as part of tonight's program, is unable to join us, but his ground will be amply covered by our other speakers. I personally have been reading about issues of ecological sustainability, food justice, related issues off and on for more than a decade. And as soon as you plunge into the subject, as you probably know, what all the books tell you to do is grow your own food. Unfortunately, in me, they're talking to, I promise, the least plant-friendly person in the country. Not only do I live in a third-floor apartment with no yard, I kill every sprout that comes through the door. My sister-in-law gave me some kind of flower in a pot last Christmas, and I said, what did that poor thing ever do to you? Luckily, a tiny bit of research led me to community-supported agriculture, the CSA movement, where you give a local farmer money to support their harvest season and then get a weekly share of the proceeds. I've belonged to three CSAs in the past 10 years or so, and I've had the pleasure of wondering what kind of greens those are, and then sautéing them anyway, learning about garlic scapes, which anybody who's belonged to a CSA is probably familiar with, and eating Jerusalem artichokes right out of the ground washed off with a hose. My current CSA gets its vegetables from an organic family farm founded in the mid-1600s. It is a century older than this library, which was founded in 1754. Because of gentle treatment and careful rotation by many generations of farmers, the soil there is still rich and fertile enough to feed hundreds of families every week and support a busy farm stand. Plus, when you meet the guy who runs the place, he tells you, completely without irony, to call him Farmer Bill. I love that. He says, hi, I'm Farmer Bill. It's fantastic. That kind of authenticity is what many of the farmers and foodies in Growing Roots are seeking and producing. In a time when it would be easy to despair about global inequality, food deserts, climate change, these people are building alternative ways of life and sustenance. I hope you are as inspired as I was, whether you can grow a potted plant or not. Please join me in welcoming Catherine Liner and Andrew Lipton to talk about Growing Roots.
So thank you. That was a lovely introduction and makes me laugh because I realize how much more there is for me to learn. I'm thinking, Jerusalem artichokes washed off with a hose. Have I been getting rid of that skin when I should leave the skin on? Because it's really dirty. I mean, really dirty. Anyway, thank you all for coming to this gem of a library, which is the last best bargain on the Upper East Side. If you don't belong, you should join. It just is endlessly wondrous. And thank you, Andrew, for being here tonight with me, as you have been through the book. And thank you to Sarah Holliday for setting this up. My parents moved to New York City in 1967. There was one health food store on the Upper East Side, one health food store midtown, and one health food store downtown. In 1976, the Green Market in New York was founded. There were 12 farmers in a parking lot on 59th Street and 2nd Avenue. In 2011, 25 years later, there are now 53 markets, farm markets, in New York City alone. 230 family farms and fishermen, and over 30,000 acres of farmland being protected from development. Across the nation, in the last 5 years since I've been working on this book, the number of farm markets has doubled, and they think that it will triple in the next 2 to 3 years. So somewhere people are wanting and desiring organic food. When I started this book in 2005, I was almost finished with the first draft of my second novel, which among other things was about racial profiling just after 9/11. My daughter was graduating from college and had announced she was moving out, going to live downtown, and I was so panicked about the state of the world and the state of my finances and the fact that I was soon to be an empty nester when the only thing that really mattered to me was cooking dinner and eating with the family. So I was low, to say the least. And rather than wallow in it, I decided I would take my dog and head west, where I live part-time in a small rural town, as most of you know, in rural Colorado. Just outside of Kansas City, I happened to glance down at my gas gauge, and I saw that it was nearing empty. So I pulled off the motorway onto a dirt road, looking for a gas station, not very smart. But in the far distance, I saw a tractor, and it was moving. So I figured, gas. And I pulled up, got out, ran up to the farmer who was sitting on the tractor and said, "Can I have some gas?" And he got down and said, "What?" We bargained for a while, and he then somehow we started talking about these beautiful goats that were in the adjoining field. This is one of them. And he told me that his parents were about to retire and that they were trying to talk him into coming back to the farm. He had just graduated from the University of Chicago. And he loved these goats. He loved this farm, and he really felt that it was an opportunity. But unfortunately, he had fallen in love with an urbanite at the university, and she wanted, coincidentally, to live in New York City. So by the end of our conversation, which ended up to be a half hour of throwing the stick for the dog, he was convinced that he was going to stay on the farm and that he was going to convince his girlfriend to come back as well. I got back in the car and started driving, and I was lifted. I started to sing, and I thought, this is so great. And his enthusiasm about this farm infected me. And I thought, how can I start to grow food? What am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And then I started thinking, you know, all over the United States, there must be hundreds, thousands of 65-year-old farmers who are about ready to retire. And who is going to take over their farm? And how are we going to get food? And I became more and more excited. And when I got to Durango, I started to do some research, and I found that there were hundreds of these folks all over the country between the ages of 19 and 39, a whole generation of these people who not only were taking over family farms, but were also involved and wanting to be involved in food-centered lives. So, you know, I wish I had written down this kid's name, or at least the exit where I had gotten off, so I could thank him, because what followed were 150 of some of the most heartfelt interviews that I've ever had with kids who are so engrossed and passionate about their lives. And it's not so unlike the Back to the Land movement in the 60s and the 70s, except there's one difference. Those folks in my generation and some of your generation, they really wanted to drop out and be sequestered, whereas these kids really want to get good food for themselves, but they also want to make sure that there is good food to be had by everybody, even those who can't necessarily afford it. For instance, Anna LaPay, who lives in Brooklyn. She's the daughter of Frances Moore LaPay. You may have read her book that was written in the 70s, Diet for a Small Planet. She's a young mother, a food writer, and an activist. She's written a number of books, one with her mother, and her latest book is Diet for a Hot Planet, that deals with the issues of this warming climate and what food will become during the next century. Bryant Terry, who now lives in Oakland and has also just become a new young father. He's a cookbook author and also a food activist, and he is teaching in the minorities in Oakland. And I asked him why he thought there were, you know, why are there not more folks of color in this movement? And his response was that, you know, remember, we've just recently gotten out of the fields. And that was something that when I started to live this book across the country, a number of people said, you know, you only have X number of folks of color in this book. And there are folks all over the United States now in minority groups. Will Allen in Minnesota is training minorities to go back into the fields, and with distinction rather than what they feel, you know, that they have risen above that. Benina Burroughs, she lives on her family's Central California acreage of almonds. And she has, in the last 5 years, turned 200 acres into organic. And you can see the hoses. They're sort of, she and her father invented this system for deep root watering Which doesn't waste a lot of water. As you know, we've got a drought going on, particularly in California and particularly in the central farmland areas. All of these trees now are organic, and she's turning 250 more acres into organic. And this is just a portion of that farm. The pollination of California's almonds is the largest annual managed pollination in the world. Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle live in one of the most remote towns in the lower 48, population 180. They run a 5-star restaurant called Hell's Backbone Grill. It is so good. It's in the heart of Boulder, Utah. Anybody been to Boulder, Utah? Not Boulder, Colorado. They're full of Mormons, survivalists, cowboys, and New Age followers. And somehow these guys managed to secure a liquor license. And so just to keep the word of wisdom in the Mormon religion a little quiet, they only serve local beer and wine. 2 miles down the road is Blake's brother, Nathaniel Spaulding, and he has 5 acres of vegetables, which he grows primarily for his family and for the restaurant. Next door to them is a small cattle ranch. Down the road is a lamb ranch, lots of lakes where the trouts jump freely, and all of this with the backdrop of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. You've just never seen anything like this. It is as beautiful, if not more so, than any valley, mountain in the world, and you can hike forever. And if you go to this area, you can stay in the lodge next door to the 5-star restaurant where they'll pack you a lunch every day of all this great food, and you can hike down in there. It's worth the drive. Nicholas Zimmer was in college, and just before graduation, he told his parents that he hated it. They were pressing him to go to college through the years. And that's the other thing which is so remarkable about most of the kids who are back in this world of agriculture and food. They're all incredibly well educated. Anyway, Nicholas convinced his parents to let him drop out. His father, who was nearing retirement age, really, he's kind of a famous dairy farmer, and he wanted to get on the road and talk about his cows and about biodynamic farming. And so he convinced them, and Nicholas is now working the dairy farm. And that dairy farm is in Spring Green, Wisconsin, which is the home of Frank Lloyd Wright. And during the summer months at Taliesin, which is the architectural school that Frank Lloyd Wright started, the 40 students used to live on the land and communally work the land. And this is the beautiful farm. Looks just like a Frank Lloyd Wright, doesn't it? All of this acreage were organic produce. And after his death, it all went to rot and ruin. And Nicholas Zimmer is bringing it now back to organic, and the kids are all working on it again, and the community is very happy. Ashley Lee Martin, she lives on the White Earth Reservation and grew up ricing in the lakes of Minnesota with her grandparents. She now has 2 children, and as you know, in the Native American culture and tribes, there's a high degree of diabetes too. So she is now working with her tribal members and Winona LaDuke, her mentor, to educate them about what to eat, how to eat it, and when to eat it. After Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the good news was that the entire town had the opportunity to remake the food system, which was very bad. This place, food desert, the entire place. As great as the food is in restaurants and so forth, it was just as bad, that bad for kids. And at one of the public middle schools where kids were failing right and left, Alice Waters and April Nugene, one of her helpers, installed an edible schoolyard. There are now 3 edible schoolyards. There's one in the first one, which is in Berkeley, California, a grammar school. The second one, which is in New Orleans and is a middle school. And the third one, which we have in Brooklyn, which is also an elementary school. And everything is taught by way of the garden, absolutely everything. History, math, writing, language. It all relates back to the garden. And if you can see right up there, that we have a rooftop garden, and all of this is food. And it's in the middle of a slum. Each of the interviews in the book are first person, so they're from the voice of each of the profiles. And I spoke to the 54 folks who are in this book for hours and hours, sometimes days, sometimes I went back months later, sometimes I went back a year later, 2 years later. Many of them I interviewed several times. Some of my favorites were in my own backyard in New York and in Colorado. The James family. This is Dan James. He's one of five kids, and they all live on this 450 acres that were purchased 35 years ago by his parents. And these kids were brought up in Durango, and the parents had the good sense to say to these kids, go out in the world, get educated, and should you desire to come back to Durango, come back with some skill. Come back with something you can bring to the farm. And so they all did. And Dan came back, married Becca, had these three little kids, and now has dairy cows and makes all kinds of good hard cheeses. I think they made their first soft cheese this summer, which was Brie, and it was very, very good. The other kids in this family, they have vegetables, and they have chickens and goats and pigs and so forth. And it's at the base of these gorgeous La Plata Mountains. And look at this grass. This was in the middle of the summer, you know. And Guernsey and Jersey cows, really beautiful. This is a chicken truck which they made, and it was designed after Joel Salatin, who is the centerfold of Omnivore's Dilemma, written by Michael Pollan. And they had to raise theirs up because they had trouble with raccoons who would actually come into the chicken truck and grab, and, you know, it was not a pretty sight. Anyway, I'm working on a children's book at the moment of Growing Roots, and their kids are the three that I interviewed first. And these kids, cooks, you can't believe it. Anyway, in upstate New York, Jen Small and Mike Yezzi. Oh, I forgot about this little grill. This is the youngest James kid, who is 23, and she built this gypsy wagon. And during the summer months, she serves grilled cheese and hamburgers and salads, all from the farm. And it's packed every day. You know, you get a hamburger for $8, and somebody said to me, who pays $8 for a hamburger? So then we had to discuss what went into that hamburger and why that hamburger was so, you know, should have been more as far as I was concerned. Anyway, this is Mike Yezzi, and his wife is Jen Small, and this is one of their two kids. And they were in public health, and Jen Small's grandmother's house was about to be torn down, and the house next to it was going to be torn down, and there was a developer who was going to build, you know, one of those lovely, attractive, useless subdivisions. And so Jen and Mike took up a collection from their family and bought this piece of land, and then they had to figure out what to do with it. Neither of them had ever farmed a day in their life. So they bought three pink pigs, Dukok pigs, from the folks down the road, and they figured that if they liked it and they could keep these pigs alive for the 6 to 7 months and grow them up and then slaughter them and eat them, all with ease, that they would keep pigs because they were the easiest thing to actually bring into the land. So as it turned out, they liked it. And then the next season, they bought 15. And then they had this really good friend, Mary Cleaver, who runs the Green Table. Anybody eaten at the Green Table? If you haven't, rush out. It's really fine. It's down at the Chelsea Market. And Mary Cleaver said, get heirloom pigs. So you see these gorgeous things. These guys are so friendly and so wondrous. Anyway, Mary Cleaver bought out all of their pigs after 9/11 and served the pork to the workers down at the site. She's really, you know, just go to taste her food and you'll... She's being honored next week, actually, by Slow Foods for the work that she's done in New York. I met Chris Jackson at Sixpen Kitchen in Pittsburgh, which was a really fine local restaurant that used all local and sustainable goods. And he had this beautiful rooftop garden, really beautiful, that he supplemented with. And his dream in life, though, was to live in Brooklyn and to have a small cafe with his sister. So 2 years after I met him, he ended up back here. Ted is his boyhood name. Honey is his sister's girlhood name. And they have this beautiful little sustainable cafe in Cobble Hill. So before the legalization of hives in New York City, there were hundreds of outlaws tending hives. Did you all know that in this city? The hives were often disguised as air conditioners. And I had a friend who had a kind of a cabinet hooked up to the plastic tubes that kids have with guinea pigs running through them. And these would, they were filtered out to the, you know, through the window so that the bees could go out and forage and come in and out as they liked. In 2010, it became legal in New York City to harvest honey. And, you know, there's still people who complain about it all the time and say that they have honeybees swarming them, which honeybees hardly ever swarm. Anyway, Andrew Cote, who was supposed to be here tonight, was one of those who made this possible. There he is, Andrew Cote. Hello. And that is one of the trays from his bee hives, of which he has, how many? 15? 16 in his front yard in Connecticut. His neighbors hate him because they all feel that the bees are going to swarm. He's been there for 15 years. The bees have never swarmed. This next photo is what they call a smoker. And that, you know, he lights it up and he goes into the hives and he calms the bees with the smoker. There is some controversy about smokers, which I won't go into, but anyway. One of, Andrew said, don't mention this, but I'm going to mention it anyway. There is one of the folks in the back of the, one of the profiles who actually claims that the smokers are almost as bad for the bees as pesticides. And you can imagine all that smoke in those poor little tiny lungs. Anyway, Andrew Cote also has this really important nonprofit, which is called Bees Without Borders. And what he does is he goes to third world countries and he starts, he helps the beekeepers who have demolished hives to restart these hives. And it's really important because, as Einstein pointed out, without the honeybee, in 4 years there would be no mankind. The ancient partnership between pollinator and plant is essential to life as we know it. It's most important. And as we also, most of us know, bee populations are struggling everywhere. But ironically, they may be doing better in the city because we have more for them to pollinate. Gardens, most of the time, flower shops, flowers out in front, you know, the flower shops. Whereas in the countryside, they're surrounded by the monocultures of industrial farms. So, speaking of industrial farms, Andrew Lipton, who is the amazing photographer, his day job is the law. And he specializes in handling chemical exposure and environmental litigation. So, I'm hoping you'll fill us in on what's happening with the bees and what's happening with us.
When Catherine first asked me to join her tonight, I was trying to think, how do I spend time talking about shutter speeds and focal lengths? And it just sounded awfully boring. And then she said, do it as a lawyer. And I thought, that could be boring too. So I'm not going to talk the law either. But I come with a background of handling all kinds of cases involving contamination of drinking water supplies, pollution from Superfund sites, and then occupational diseases caused by exposures to all kinds of toxins, asbestos, benzene, beryllium, vinyl chloride, and even pesticides. So I'm coming with that perspective, and I want to talk about how these things are affecting our lives. Now, I grew up in the New York area, and I was fed TV dinners, processed food, and I ate at some of the very first fast food restaurants in the area. I was quite lucky. Most of us are not going to be farmers. We're not going to be beekeepers or cheesemongers or ranchers. So why do we care about organic food? Why does this mean anything to us? Well, first of all, I think that organic food is more nutritious and it tastes better. But it takes a lot of work to eat organically and sustainably. It's hard. But when we look at the way conventional food is grown and now processed in today's world, what we can see is that the food industry is becoming so pervasive and is causing such devastating problems that we can't ignore it. And I want to focus just on water issues for a moment. When you talk about genetically engineered crops, and there are more and more of them all the time, as an example, this is genetically engineered corn. The giveaway is it looks beautiful, right? But there are two ears here opposite each other. That's not how corn is meant to grow. Corn is meant to grow on a single stalk. Now, the problem with it is that each plant of corn that is genetically modified needs more water than a conventional plant. So it's using more of a rare resource. The other problem is that when you have a shortage of water, in drought conditions, organically grown crops will help the soil hold water better. So actually what we found is when they talk about GMO corn being so great and so productive, when tests were done at the University of Pittsburgh, what they found was after 5 to 7 years, organic corn was growing just as productively as GMO corn. And it was more productive when there were water shortage years. So big issue in terms of water from GMO crops. The other thing that I want to mention is confined area food operations. We hear about feedlots. There are feedlots for cows, for pigs, for sheep, for chickens. Well, they cause unprecedented amounts of water pollution. There are literally tons and tons of manure in each one of these feedlots that are kept in holding ponds. They're disgusting. This is a feedlot operation. This is used just to cover up the tons of manure. This is how the cows are confined. Or you can raise your cows this way. So those are problems. Chemical fertilizers. When you have large industrial farms, they want to use a monoculture, as Catherine mentioned. They want to grow one crop. It's easier, which means they're not rotating the same way, which means they need to use more fertilizer. The problem with the fertilizers is it erodes and leaches into the groundwater, and it's poisoning surface waters and groundwaters. Same thing with pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, and herbicides. They're sprayed, they're contained in plants, it all gets into our water supply. Most environmental scientists agree that the greatest problem facing this planet for the future is finding clean, potable water for the billions of people on the earth. Now, I don't want to go into this in general terms, so I want to talk about two aspects of these problems that when you first hear about them, you think, who cares about bees? Who cares about cows? But when you look closely at the problems, you suddenly see that they're the tip of a giant iceberg with major problems for all of us. So the two things that I want to talk about are pesticides and bees, and then growth hormones that are given to cows. So pesticides. First of all, I handled my first pesticide case decades ago. And these were cases involving applicators of the pesticides who came up with acute and chronic problems. The acute problems would be kinds of central nervous system deficits and disorders. They'd have stomach problems. They'd have respiratory problems. There are actual cases of pesticide applicators going into coma and dying. The chronic effects from pesticide use are neurological deficits such as Parkinson's disease, reproductive injuries, infertility, birth defects. And we know that pesticides cause certain kinds of cancers, particularly leukemias and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, probably due to the benzene that's contained in the pesticides because they're all petrochemical based. Pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, and herbicides are used in huge amounts all over the planet. Over 1 billion tons of pesticides are used in the United States alone each year. There are over 20,000 different kinds of pesticides registered with the US EPA. Now, unfortunately, studies, not by industry, but independent studies have shown that 95% of sprayed pesticides reach a destination other than the target species. So where are all these pesticides going? Well, they're found in rainwater, surface water. They're found in the groundwater. USGS, the United States Geological Survey, went out and tested streams and rivers in the United States. And every single stream and river they tested was found to contain pesticides. When they started looking at drinking water wells, 90% of the drinking water wells that were tested contained pesticide, and many of them in excess of the permissible limits from EPA. We're exposed daily to pesticides, not just in the water, but in aerosols, dusts, and vapors that we breathe in all the time. Often pesticides are sprayed onto food, especially fruits and vegetables, and the pesticides remain even after you wash the fruit or the vegetable because it penetrates the skin or the peel, and it gets into the meat of the plant and accumulates there. When they started testing humans for pesticides, 100% of the people tested, every single one, had at least trace residues of pesticides in their blood and urine. Now, this is most problematic for children because they're the most susceptible and sensitive to pesticide poisoning. And also, these pesticides bioaccumulate. So the older you get, the more and more there is. So when you're very young, if you start at a young age with accumulation, it can cause greater and greater problems. On the other hand, what was curious, when they took people and put them on an organic diet, after a period of time, the subject's pesticide levels were reduced to undetectable. And that's because organic food cannot use chemical pesticides. Okay. But pesticides have another impact that I want to talk about. Many of you have heard about colony collapse disorder, and that's the destruction of bee populations. Now, Catherine mentioned the smoker, and I know Katrina Blair, who's in the book, worried that the smokers cause a problem. It depends what you are burning in it, but they've used smokers for hundreds of years without having problems. Colony collapse only happened within the last number of years. Probably less than 10 years. Well, what happened? In the last 10 years, a new kind of pesticide, a neurotoxin for insects, started to be used. It is called nicotinoid or something like that. So there are just two different kinds of them used starting in about 2003. About the same time that colony collapse began. Now, there may be many causes, but this clearly has now been identified as a major cause of colony collapse, these specific pesticides. These neurotoxins are sprayed onto crops, but they're also, what they'll do is they'll spray it onto seeds. So they treat the seeds and coat it with these neurotoxins. Then the seeds are planted. The plants grow up, and they have these neurotoxins in the plants themselves. It oozes out in the nectar and the pollen and the water produced by the plants. Honeybees then eat the pollen or the nectar, drink the water. They get these neurotoxins in them. what are even undetectable amounts have been shown to weaken the immune systems of bees. So now they're susceptible to all kinds of pathogens and getting all kinds of diseases. But in the greater amounts, the neurotoxins cause memory loss and navigation disruption. The bees get lost. They can't find their way back to the hive. But it also causes paralysis, and it kills them. It turns out that honeybees are ingesting these two different kinds of insect neurotoxins at levels 1,000 times greater than Bayer Crop Science, the manufacturer, claimed they would be doing. The result is a third of the bee population in this country is lost every year. Why do we care about what happens to bees? I remember as a little boy running in the backyard and falling into a bush, and there was a beehive in the bush. I got dozens of bee stings. Bees are not fun. Why do we want them? The USDA has stated that one out of every three bites of food we eat depends upon bee pollination. So a third of our food supply depends upon our having a thriving bee population. Kill off the bees, and you destroy our ability to produce the food we need to eat. By the way, most European countries ban the use of neurotoxins. Now, if this is depressing, I can talk about f-stops and... GMOs. Oh, one more photo. That was Catherine's most difficult interview. Genetic engineering, or GMOs, genetically modified organisms. They become one of my pet peeves. Genetically engineered crops and food additives are pervasive in this country. We're fed GMO corn. GMO corn is used to make high fructose corn syrup that is put into about every processed food we eat or you eat. There's GMO soy, cotton, and canola. They're all used to make the cooking oils that we cook our organic food in. We eat GMO soybeans. There are GMO potatoes, zucchinis, squash. They're now flavor saver tomatoes that are genetically engineered to have a longer shelf life. We are fed GMO enzymes, flavorings, and process agents. If you use NutraSweet aspartame, genetically modified. Rennet, GMO rennet, is used to make a lot of cheeses, particularly processed cheeses. So you don't eat processed food. Well, if you have meat, dairy, eggs from animals that are not organically raised, the cattle, sheep, pigs, and chickens are all fed GMO feed, so you're getting it that way. At least 75% of our processed food contains genetically modified ingredients, but you never know it because none of these products are labeled to indicate that they contain GMOs. Not one. Now, we've been told that genetically engineered crops are the same as non-GMOs. They're just as safe, they're just as healthy in all respects. And Monsanto will promise you that. But independent studies have shown otherwise. Take the potato. It was genetically modified by inserting bacteria DNA to allow these potatoes to create their own pesticides. So when you eat a GMO potato, you're getting the pesticide that's innate because of the modification, and you're getting bacteria DNA that you've never had before. When people compare genetic modification to splicing a plant on a tree, when you combine by grafting, for example, you're not taking bacteria and sticking it into a potato. It's a totally different kind of process, and trying to compare the two just doesn't work. Research has also shown that the nutritional content of GMO potatoes is not the same as conventional potatoes. In fact, GMO potatoes have 20% less protein. When you take rats and you feed them GMO potatoes, it damages their immune systems, so they're much more susceptible to infection and disease. What happens to us when we eat GMO potatoes? Well, we can't go out and test our own immune systems. but you may have to wonder. Test animals have also been found to have less developed brains, livers, and testicles, all because they've been fed GMO potatoes. There's also a proliferation of cells in the stomach and the intestine. Now, when you have cell proliferation, it's an indication of an increased risk of cancer. Now, can we say that GMO potatoes cause cancer? No, we don't know. But certainly the risk is there, and no one is doing any of the studies to determine it. If you take an animal, whether it's a pig, a sheep, a cow, and you give them two bins, one with conventional food, and not even organic, just conventionally grown, and one with GMO food, same food, they will always pick the non-GMO food. Animals know. We're not given that choice because the FDA has ruled that genetically modified foods need not be labeled. At the same time, the FDA has made it virtually impossible to label products as GMO-free. The other problem I have with the FDA in this regard is that they require virtually no testing of the effects of GMOs on people. There's no pre-market safety test that's mandated by the FDA. Nothing is done to check for long-term effects of the GMOs on the human being, and nothing is even done to check about allergic reactions that we may have. So the U.S. food supply is inundated with GMO products. On the other hand, most GMOs are banned in the rest of the developed world. All of Europe, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and Japan all ban GMO food products. We don't. Now, the big difference in is a difference in approach. The other developed nations follow something called the precautionary principle. And basically what they say is they're not going to approve a product, including GMOs, unless and until it is proven to be safe. In the United States, the opposite is true. A product can be put into the stream of commerce until it is proven to do harm. Now, Monsanto is not going to go out of its way to prove that its GMO products do harm. Who else can afford to do the testing? That's why these things are released, and that's why it's so difficult to take them off the market, because of this totally difference in approach. When testing is required, such as, I'll come to that in a moment. When testing is required in the United States, basically, it's minimal. When you look at the tests, they're often misleading. And very often you see that the data has been manipulated. Now, I've seen this, and we've all heard about it with respect to tobacco. I've seen it with respect to asbestos. I've seen it with respect to lead poisoning. I've seen it in all different kinds of products. Why should GMOs be any different? The same cover-up is going on. So let's talk about a specific problem of this. Recombinant bovine growth hormone. Took me a while just to pronounce it. RBGH. It's an artificial growth hormone that's given to dairy cows to increase milk production. It was developed by my best friend Monsanto, and is now marketed by a subsidiary of Eli Lilly. RBGH is great because when it's injected into dairy cows, it increases their milk production by 10 or 15%. Why is it banned in every developed country except the United States? Why did the USDA or the FDA approve the use of RBGH when everyone else banned it? Well, because of this precautionary principle, Monsanto could not prove to the European countries that RBGH was safe. In the United States, all they had to do was submit a single study where this growth hormone was fed to 30 rats for 90 days. The study was never published. Monsanto gave the FDA only a summary of the results that it prepared, and they never released the underlying data. Now, if you know anything about animal studies, if it's less than 2 years, don't even talk about it. A 90-day study is less than worthless. But FDA approved it, and now over 50% of the large dairy herds in the United States are injected with RBGH. Now, independent researchers have found a number of problems associated with the use of this growth hormone. And by the way, it is a genetically modified hormone. Milk from RBGH-treated cows have higher levels of insulin growth factor. It's called IGF-1. Now, we don't know what IGF-1 from milk in humans that drink it, what that causes. We've not been able to study that. But we do know that increased levels of IGF-1 in humans has been associated with colon cancer, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. So we do also know that the milk from cows given RBGH will have this IGF-1 insulin factor, and the insulin factor is not killed or reduced by pasteurization. So this potential carcinogen, we know, is in the milk. We drink it, our kids drink it, and our grandchildren drink it. Because FDA approved a study on 30 rats in 90 days and let it go, and has done nothing ever since. Another problem. About 25% of the cows given RBGH develop mastitis. This is an infection of the udder. To prevent this, they're given antibiotics, prophylactic antibiotics. We've all heard of the problem. This is one of the main reasons. That and because of the risk of infection from the confined feed operations, the feedlots. So they're given all of these antibiotics. Well, the antibiotics, again, are not killed by pasteurization, so they then appear in the milk. This creates the risk, of course, of reducing the effectiveness of the antibiotics for ourselves, but it also increases the risk of creating antibiotic-resistant organisms. Why on earth would FDA approve RBGH in milk after these studies? Well, there's a revolving door between the FDA and Monsanto. We've seen many FDA officials now with Monsanto, but the reverse is also true. The woman who wrote the FDA's opinion on why RBGH milk should not be labeled had previously worked as a researcher for Monsanto on this hormone. But not only did she take the position that the public has no right to know it's being fed genetically modified foods, she also improved an increase in the permissible antibiotic levels in milk. Previously, it had been one part antibiotic per 100 million parts of milk. But they had to use all these antibiotics because of the mastitis problem with RBGH. So she increased it to it went from one part per 100 million to one part per million. So it's a 100-fold increase in the amount of antibiotics. But there's another little twist in it. This is not total antibiotics. It's for each separate antibiotic that they may use. So when they give this whole melange of antibiotics to a cow, each one can be one part per million. Another problem is that Michael Taylor, he's the FDA commissioner responsible for overseeing the approval of the use of GMOs. He also wrote the labeling guidelines, making it difficult, virtually impossible, to label milk as RBGH-free. Who is he? Well, before joining the FDA, he was a Monsanto lawyer. I love lawyers. He then became a Monsanto vice president and its chief lobbyist, particularly with the FDA. He's now the FDA's food safety czar. If that's not getting the fox to guard the hen house, nothing is. So what do we do to protect ourselves? Well, I doubt we're going to change anytime soon the way corporations influence our government in this country. Laws and the regulations will continue to make it difficult to know what's safe to eat. The government will continue to subsidize farming practices that are not environmentally sound and that foster the poisoning of our air, water, and soil. So we have to figure this out on our own. We have to keep asking questions and demanding answers. You go into a grocery store, and generally the grocer will have no idea where the food came from, whether it has GMOs or anything else. Only way is to talk to the farmer. Farmers markets, CSAs, asking questions. Well, do you use pesticides? Do you use chemical pesticides? What kind of fertilizers do you use? All these kinds of questions. But basically, we know that eating organic, sustainable foods avoids ingestion of harmful pesticides and fertilizers. It reduces the negative impacts on the environment and generally provides us with safe and nutritious food. The profiles in Growing Roots, I had to come back to the book sometime, were passionate about their lives. We need to find the same kind of passion in the small ways we can protect ourselves and our children and the environment by how we eat. Catherine.
So we have some taste tests over there if anybody would like to.
Do you want to do questions?
Or... Oh, questions. Does anybody have questions? Janie.
Hi. I'm really interested in the bees. The bees are that, what if they carry, does it have a queen and a, I mean, how does it work physically?
Well, I think he brings some bees with him when he goes to these foreign countries. He brings a queen. Oh. He brings supplies, bees and so forth. Unfortunately, I can't really answer any of Andrew's questions, Cote's questions, but I can give you his email, and then you can ask him. But I, to the best of my recollection, he brings a queen. You know, he goes to two or three places while he's over there, and he brings queens, and he starts it up. Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. He's gone all over. He's not. This isn't, no, nothing to do with it. But he, you know, it's the same kind of, he has specific people that he works with over and over again who place him in different places. He's been to Cuba recently. I know that.
He has a
website. Right. Yeah. It's a great, it's a, I don't know how updated it is, but did you? Well, the first thing I would do is buy Growing Roots, because that will give you a choice. It gives you a choice of all of the various and sundry things that one can do. But, you know, the best way is to hang at your local farmer's market. That is the very, very first place that I really felt saved, you know. Andrew?
I would add two other things.
CSA.
Throw out your microwave and forget about
check your labels.
Forget about processed foods.
Check your labels. I mean, what's really interesting is I went to Fairway today. It was my first time at Fairway, and I was looking for organic apples. And there was a, they had local apples, but they were not local and organic. And they had organic, but they were not local. So what I did was I happened to have farmers market apples in my fridge, which are also organic, and so I bought the local from Fairway. So I thought I could cut up an apple and give you guys a taste, because as the kids from Edible Schoolyard say, once you taste the difference between organic and conventional, you'll never go back. There's no choice. You don't have a choice anymore. And then I also brought two syrups, one Log Cabin. How many of you use Log Cabin or Aunt Jemima syrup? Well, it's filled mostly, I could read you the label, but it's mostly corn syrup and corn syrup. and some more corn syrup. Whereas if you use an organic, and I just happen to have my daughter's maple syrup here, which just comes straight from the tree into the boiler. And I thought you might want to just taste the difference. And then you can make your own decisions. But, not to be crypt about it, check labels. That's the most important thing. And also, in California, they are now voting on whether or not GMOs should be labeled. And it was thrown off the ballot 3 years ago. And a man by the name of Jeffrey Smith, who is really a genius in terms of putting together all of this, is he's got a little plan, and it's got a tipping point. And we will be voting on the same things. I mean, we just want to know what's in our food. Just let us know what's in our food.
Actually, one last question. You made the remark, Andrew, that I understand the government not requiring manufacturers to label. But you also made the remark that you're not allowed, that people are permitted. It seems to me that Connecticut, I can remember Stonyfield or whether it's Connecticut, whether Connecticut milks, but it says on the thing, no GMO, some people are finding ways
Well, there are a couple of things that have been happening. First of all, the justification for the FDA rule was that if you say no RBGH, it suggests that RBGH is dangerous or harmful or creates an increased risk, and the FDA has found that it doesn't create it. So therefore, it's a misleading label.
So complicated.
So at times, when these companies do it, Monsanto or some of the other companies will actually go after them. At times, the FDA will. There have been a few ways to breach that in how they word some of the labels. If you say that it is no GMOs or RBGH free, and then include the language that the FDA has found that there is no increased risk from RB, then you can do it and things like that. Well, so it becomes a meaningless, confusing label.
Well, Andrew and I have arguments about this because there are actual, you can go into a market or even into a health food store or co-op and you can pick up some products and they actually will say contains no GMOs. So in certain states, you can do that.
Yeah. I know I've seen it.
I'm sure
there's
you have.
The difference between GMOs and RBGH.
Okay. Right.
The Europeans will not permit genetically modified produce, wheat, corn.
Right, that soy, means that they will not take our produce.
And the animals that eat this produce
also will not. Now, we've lost lots of money on cattle.
So in other words, the
export. Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
The UN, when they want to purchase crops to donate to a starving, to Somalia, will not buy genetically modified crops.
And yet
American farmers continue to, because use, for example, GMO corn. Well, the bulk of it now is used to make high fructose corn syrup. That's not being exported the same way. And it's being used to make ethanol. So they're not losing tremendous amounts from that.
Have the Europeans done any research?
Virtually all of the research that I was talking about was done in Europe.
It's mostly done in Europe, yeah. Except for what Jeffrey Smith has done. And his sources are European. But in terms of our lives, in keeping things simple, we all know how to do that. And in the same way, when these things come up on the ballot, there's not an awful lot we can do about people who are appointed. But we can, there are all kinds of websites and growing roots, fooddemocracy.com, Slow Foods. There are all sorts of food groups that we can get involved with that will keep us involved in the latest and greatest. But the good news is that we can find all of these foods right here in New York City. We have the greatest, really, really, one of the greatest markets in the world. You find what?
In the food emporium, they sell organic.
Yes, they do.
Be organic and
local. Right, right. And we have to ask for it in regular markets. I mean, I was fried when I got out of Fairway. There was just so much there. I didn't know what to do.
Can organic food be genetically modified, or is organic by definition not?
No. Yes. It is. Organic food is not GMO'd. You mean, are the... You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that, you know, that certain farms are struggling. They're, you know, all over. But it seems to me, Andrew and I have been going across the country. This is our second year of doing it. And I did a talk at a small library in a really tiny town in Colorado, and I interviewed four farmers, and those four farmers, you know, they just have, they're living great. You know, they say business has picked up, their CSAs are huge. There was one that had, you know, 315, and there was another one who had 8 members. So, you know, but 8 members was all that they could manage with this farm. So I don't know the answer to that question across the country, but with all of the folks that are in this book, I have met, for each farmer I've met, they have introduced me to 10 others, and they're all doing well. And there was a piece in the New York Times over the summer that said that there were some farmers that were complaining because they didn't have enough people coming to the farmers market because there were so many farms now and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, and that's why I'm working on a book for kids, is we have to educate the next generation. And people have to begin to understand. I mean, there's so many people who do not understand the benefits of organic versus all of the good news that Andrew just gave us. So there's an awful lot of food out there that's really, really good. And we just have to find it. And I always feel like the other day, the day of the big, you know, storm, I made Andrew go to the farmer's market with me. And they were all cleaning up at 11 o'clock, and we got there at about 10. And it was so joyous to be there with these people, you know. And if we don't go, then, you know, I always think nobody will go. But, you know, as I'm driving down there, I think all these people are going. And mostly we don't drive. We drove on this day because the weather was so bad. But there they all were with their wares, you know. So I don't know if they're disappearing, and I don't like to think about it. I just go and buy. That's all I can advise you guys to do. Any other questions? Does anybody want to taste the difference between log cabin syrup and Poor Farm Farm? Okay.